Hello, I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
And I'm Gudrun Wolf.
And I'm Maria Demergis.
And I'm André Sapir.
And welcome back to The Sound of Economics. Today, we are going to have a special episode as the year 2020 is coming to an end. We are going to start by reviewing this special year in economic policy and beyond. Then we are going to discuss the most interesting books we have read this year. And then we will wrap up looking into things to come. Obviously, when I mention any attempt to a forecast exercise of any sort, I need to remind myself and all of us that things, as we've seen in 2020, can go in directions which are completely unexpected. As we all know what went completely wrong this year, I would like to ask Gudrun, Maria and André to start with telling us one thing in economic policy that you actually got it right at the beginning of the year.
Well, I mean, look, I think the one point that I think we all got right is that interest rates and inflation would remain subdued. Now, we were probably not thinking that they would sort of fall even further, which they did because of the pandemic. But, you know, we all sort of thought we were in a low rate environment. And I think that's certainly a feature that will also stay with us for some time, it seems to me. So this low rate, low macro environment, I think, is certainly one point I would highlight that we got right.
As far as I'm concerned, what I may have gotten right, but we don't know yet, is a deal between the EU and the UK. I always maintained that there would be a deal, although now we are end of December and we still don't know.
And Maria, what about you?
Yeah, since we're going in that direction, I think I would like to say that I predicted the US elections correctly. I mean, although at this point, I think there was much more of a hope than actually getting it right. But, likely we got that one correct.
Thank you. And from the things that you might have gotten right to the thing that we never would have expected to happen. And of course, I'm referring to the pandemic. And I would like to make you listen to zoom in one of our guests, distinguished guest that we hosted in one of our event that will tell us her take on what has been going on at the beginning of all this.
In mid-March, as concern about the pandemic escalated, financial markets came under extreme stress. And in the United States, the Fed was forced to intervene massively on an emergency basis to stem asset fire sales and contagion and to keep credit flowing.
This was Janet Yellen, upcoming Treasury Secretary of the United States, which was speaking at Bruegel's annual meetings about the beginning of the economic fallout of the pandemic and the immediate reactions of markets and institutions, specifically in the United States. If I may, Janet allows us to introduce the moment of, let's say, even panic that we all have been experiencing at the beginning of the pandemic and the subsequent reactions that have been taken on an emergency basis. And I would like to go through with you a little bit this phase, which was very challenging for everyone.
I mean, I think the beginning of the pandemic took the world by surprise. And I have to say it was a surprise that should have been prevented because the data of how the virus was spreading and the information was actually available quite a bit before financial markets and policymakers woke up to the point. But, you know, when it happened, it all happened very rapidly. And I remember, of course, the massive financial stress also in the European markets, which was then even aggravated by a statement by the president of the European Central Bank, who argued that, well, the ECB is not there in the business to close spreads. And at that stage, I really had that feeling, okay, here we have the biggest pandemic, which will probably lead to the biggest economic decline since World War II in Europe. And there's no Europe, right? I mean, there's not even an ECB that stands there and stands behind the Eurozone. So I really have to admit that was a moment where I really thought, oh my God, what's going to happen now? And, you know, then I think fortunately, the ECB reacted extremely quickly and understood the mistake and, you know, came up with a very, very important program, the so-called Pandemic Emergency Purchase Program, PEPP, which really stabilized markets tremendously and really gave a massive breathing space to all European governments to do what they have to do in such a situation, namely use fiscal policy to stabilize the economy. And so I really think that was a crucial moment, and the national fiscal response then was quite strong in different countries. Now then we can discuss how it unveiled, and there was then a need for complementing that with a European response, not just national fiscal response, but really then after this first shock, and then ECB delivered, and then national governments essentially could deliver.
Indeed.
And after that, it was also Europe that delivered in massive forms as well. So I think this is an important point, in particular, if you want to say kind of surprises that we saw this year. I think one of the big surprises that we saw this year in response to the pandemic is this idea of coming together and issuing common debt. If you had asked me last year whether we would have seen the issuance of common debt at the European level, I would have told you no, never. And yet, of course, it took a sizable shock. Admittedly, it wasn't a small thing. But still, I think Europe, I think what Guntram said is right, the first hiccups, I think Europe came together in ways that were very different to the way that Europe came together back in the financial crisis. So quite clearly, Europe had learned the essence of reacting both fast and big. And I think Europe delivered in this respect, even if many believe that more could happen.
I would say, as far as I'm concerned, that was the biggest mistake I made. Is not to believe that Europe would be able to surmount issuing debt. I mean, I did realize that we were facing a big crisis, but still I did not think that Europe would surmount its shyness, essentially the treaty hurdles that were there. And so I think an interesting element is to try to understand why did Europe do the right thing, in a sense, despite the constraints from the treaty. And I think to link it to the discussion that we probably will have later, I think I would summarize it in one word, which is geopolitics. I think that played a huge role. I think Europe understood that we do live in a fragile world and not always a friendly world, and that unless we have cohesion, economic and political cohesion, it could have had very, very severe consequences for the future of Europe.
For recovery to be truly successful, we must recover together and use this opportunity to transform our economy. Together for Europe's recovery, not for nothing have we chosen this as our motto for Germany's council presidency. Recovery will only work if we do it together.
So this was the Minister of Finance of Germany also at the Brussels event, exactly pointing out this need of doing it together and this need of taking the chance of the pandemic to transform the European economy. And I think this is a good bridge for the subsequent step of what has been going on in the year and the debate that we had at Brussels level, but also all over in the capitals, in the whole European Union, about how to overcome this moment and go beyond the first emergency, which we just recalled, towards something that is more in the long, medium term for the economic stability and the growth of the continent. So I would like to give back the ball to you and keep commenting on this evolution.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to react to also what André said, which is, you know, why in the end did we get this recovery fund, right? This European joint recovery fund with EU issuance. And I really think, I mean, the geopolitical point is sort of the backdrop against which it happened. But it seems to me there were really very concrete reasons why, in the end, Germany, and in particular the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, changed her position. And as she changed her position, she not only did it on her own, she really carried her party along with that decision, which was absolutely fundamental for doing it. And I really think the three reasons are, I mean, the first was really, I think, the growing rise of Euroscepticism in the rest of the Eurozone, and in particular in some southern countries. I mean, that was very strongly debated. And, you know, everybody saw that Italy was heavily hit by the pandemic and really was suffering. People were dying, literally. And people in Germany understood, well, I mean, the Italians see no European response and really feel fed up with Europe, right? And I think that was a huge thing in the German debate. And I really think that was one important reason. The second reason, it seems to me, was that there was really the moment where various big companies and also industry representatives were urging for a joint European response. I mean, I see that BDI, the German Industry Association, together with the French and the Italian, were actually arguing, well, we need a joint response, because if we don't have a joint response, we can forget about our single market, right? Because some countries pay huge subsidies to their companies while others don't. And, you know, that means the end of the single market. So we need some joint response. Otherwise, the single market, which is the base of prosperity, also of the German economy. And I really think the third point, and we haven't talked much about that, was the court ruling in Karlsruhe, so the German Constitutional Court, which took a very strong decision against the legality of the quantitative easing program, the previous quantitative easing program of the ECB. Now, that decision came as a complete shock to the German political establishment. And I really think Mrs. Merkel and the CDU leadership understood that there is a need to send a strong signal. In the end, we are committed pro-Europeans. We really want Germany to be in the European Union. And as Germany shifted its position, then essentially, and I think that still shows the importance of the Franco-German tandem, as Germany together with France then came up with a proposal, they essentially pulled it through. I mean, of course, it's the final agreement is not what they initially proposed, but it's fairly, I mean, it's 70%, 80% close to it. So I really think in the end, these three reasons were major in Germany. And as Germany shifted, you know, basically, let's say more skeptical Northern European countries that was later on called Frugal Force, they could oppose a bit, but, you know, they couldn't completely kill the whole idea.
Was this really an Hamiltonian moment for the European Union?
No, it's not a Hamiltonian moment. We haven't created a federal Europe. I think that to the extent that this is what Hamiltonian means, we haven't. So I think that's an important thing. But the hurdle that we overcame is enormous. And I think that's why I've put so much significance on this, because it would have been very difficult to think of something like this happening. Is it the beginning towards a federation? Well, you know, this is debatable. Remember that this is a one-off thing. The issuance of common debt is one-off. After the 7-year period of the next budgetary cycle, this will not exist. At least there is no automaticity. I have arguments that I think this might actually continue, but we are very far from knowing that. So no, I don't think it is a Hamiltonian moment, but it is nevertheless a significant event in history.
I agree. It is something that will remain in the history books, that decision. It is true that if you read the legal opinion from the Council Secretariat, it explicitly indicates that it has to be temporary. So this is the condition under which this is compatible with the treaty. So from a legal perspective, it has to be temporary. In a sense, it is precisely not a Hamiltonian moment if you read it from a legal perspective. Politics is obviously different. Politicians will remember this the next time there is a crisis. And it's hard for me to believe that it is not the beginning of a use in emergency conditions of this kind of fiscal facility. So I don't think it's a permanent facility that would be used at any point, but I think it's permanent in case of crisis. The next time around, sure, people will remember that Europe did it. And, you know, why shouldn't we do it again? So in that sense, it is really historical. It is really opening the door to something that will remain.
Going a little bit further and looking into 2021, because the debate over the recovery fund and the Next Generation EU, it's not completely finalized. What is your prediction moving from this emergency moment, this big political push that has been made to implementation? What shall we expect when it comes to implementation?
Look, I think it's clear that although the decision was taken in July, while we were still in emergency situation, it was meant for the recovery, right? It's a recovery and resilience. It's not for the immediate short term. It was never meant to be money for 2020. It's money for 2021 and 2022 and a few years ahead of that. So it's a medium term. So it gave short term a signal. It gave a political signal, and it gave a signal also to everyone and to the markets that Europe stands ready to do what is necessary. And it calmed down, obviously, everybody's expectation. And that was a huge role. But in terms of the spending of the money, it is indeed money for the medium term. And it is money, I think, well designed to deal with primarily two issues, which is the climate transformation and the digital transformation. So in a sense, it is having an assessment of what are the main issues looking forward of Europe beyond the pandemic? What are the big issues? What are the big trends that Europe needs to be ready for and to transform itself? So I would say it's a fund for transformation rather than for recovery. And I think rightly so. This medium-term perspective is right in my view. And now we shall see how it is implemented. And there are a number of issues. But I think the vision was the correct vision.
I mean, if I can add to André, I mean, I think the vision is very important, and implementation is, of course, key. And the success with the implementation will determine also how much that instrument will ever be looked at again in the future as a possible crisis instrument for the next pandemic or the next financial crisis or whatever crisis may come in the next decades. I have to admit, I do have some worries as regards the instrument. And I think my key worry is really about the governance of the whole mechanism. What we are creating here really is an instrument where the EU, the Commission, goes to financial markets, borrows, but then essentially pays out that money to member states with pretty limited capacity to oversee how money is being used and, you know, how to ensure that good value for citizens is the result of that money. And that puts this program, I think, quite apart from typical programs that exist in fiscal federations. So if you have a normal fiscal federation and there is a big crisis, well, the federal level goes on to borrow, but it doesn't borrow to pass it on to member parts of the federation to do whatever they want. I mean, usually there is some sort of a federal program. There is a federal unemployment insurance. There is a federal pension system that gets supported. There's a federal building program that gets supported under federal oversight. Now, here it's a completely different construction. And that construction is quite a difficult one. And it's also true that the public goods that, you know, André and I want there to be produced. So climate change, I mean, climate mitigation, all of these things. These public goods will not be produced by the federal level, by the EU institutions. It will be the national governments that will have to deliver the job. Their incentives may not be aligned with what the EU money wants. So I have to admit, I'm very positive that this is decided. And I think it was the right thing. It's a great achievement to do it through the European Commission, through the EU institutions, with some EU Parliament oversight. So these are the right decisions. But I am worried, and I would wish, to be quite honest, for the next crisis, that we prepare and have an instrument which ensures a bit of a different structure, which ultimately allows for greater accountability and greater oversight from those that actually borrow on behalf of the Union, namely the EU institutions.
It's only been 10 months since we presented the European Green Deal. It was our transformative agenda to combine policies to tackle climate change, to reverse biodiversity loss, and to eliminate pollution by moving to a circular economy. But it's more than that. The Green Deal is Europe's new growth strategy, a strategy where environmental, economic, and social sustainability go hand in hand. And because for too long, they didn't go hand in hand.
This was Frans Timmermans, the Vice President of the European Commission, also speaking at one of our Bruegel events. And by the way, in the show notes, you will find the links of the full events recording for each of those quotes that we've been using for this special episode of The Sound of Economics. And what I wanted to add with is that you were mentioning some of the challenges there are in the European economy, and together with the recovery plan after the pandemic, the other big issue, as Timmermans has been pointing out, is the green challenge, and how the Green Deal has been announced even before the pandemic was to be the new growth agenda of the Union, to change the way also industrial policy is being conducted, but not only. So I would like to try to see, what do we learn out of this? Because it was announced in Pompa Magna last year when the new commission started the term. But then obviously the pandemic came in between, and now we have the situation where we are in with a recovery plan which is trying to marry many things that were there. I mean, as Guntram has pointed out, there is like some specific also longer term goals that the next budget of the EU would like to achieve together with the recovery after the pandemic.
If I may start, perhaps, there is no doubt that the Green Deal really is a big deal. There is no doubt about that in my view. So at the European level, but I mean, interestingly, I think also at the public opinion level, which I think is crucial, because you can't have a big deal of a policy if you don't have the backup from basically the public. And I think the European public is very much decided on this. What I think is less clear are basically two things. The first one is, what does the rest of the world think about of this? Because this is a global public good, and you know, we can put all the effort to achieve certain goals and ambitions. But without the support of the global public opinion, global policymakers, we will be seriously hindered. So there, I think it's an important constraint, if in the bad scenario, or also an enabler in a good scenario. But the other thing, which I think is crucial, is that there is a lot of details that are still missing in terms of how can you do it. And you know, the way that I like to think about it is, as a metric of how we can achieve this, is how is my personal life going to be affected as a result of this Green Deal? You know, how am I going to change my consumption, my travel, my eating as a result of that? And I, you know, I think it's important to put some of these details in order to understand both the macroeconomic cost, but also the necessary behavior changes that we need to make in order to meet our ambitions. Because our ambitions are high, but I'm not entirely sure that our actions are tantamount to those ambitions.
Well, what I would add to this is the following. I think that Europe has been needing for quite a while a growth initiative in a structural sense to raise the level of growth in Europe. I'm not talking from a macroeconomic viewpoint. Okay, what was done obviously in 2020 in terms of monetary policy and fiscal policy. I'm talking structural measures to raise the level of growth. I mean, we are in a situation of aging of population. We have high debts. We have costly social models. This is a complicated equation. You know, to have low growth, aging population, and an ambitious social model, this is not very sustainable, it seems to me. So one does need, and one has needed for a long time, I think, a growth strategy. And at the same time, I think politically, it's clear that earlier attempts at having a growth strategy have not been very successful from a political viewpoint, opposed from different circles. One circle was the Greens, very often, who felt that green and growth did not go together, because they felt that, you know, more growth would be more destruction of the environment and climate. So I think that indeed the Green Growth Initiative, the Green Deal, is, I think, the right opening to have a strategy of growth, which we need, but which can also rally politically citizens. Young citizens, I think, in Europe and throughout the world are very, very much in favor of initiatives for climate. They are very concerned about their future and the future of the planet. And I do believe indeed that it is possible, and I think that will be, I think, the big challenge of the coming year, to combine green and growth, that they are not necessarily opposed to one another, that more growth doesn't need to mean more pollution and more destruction of the planet. that indeed there are ways to combine that. And that provided that indeed this is happening, we can do good for the climate and we can do good for growth and for the sustainability, not just in terms of environment, but also in terms of the social model and in terms of economy.
And indeed, André, this debate between growth and degrowth might be one of the big dividing line, ideologically speaking, of the decades to come. But speaking about dividing lines and what is going on with the green agenda, as Maria mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, this section of this podcast, there is a global perspective over there. And I'm looking at Guntram about what shall we expect for 2021, not only at the European level, but at the global level when it comes to the implementation of all this.
Thanks, Giuseppe. And I think, as Maria already highlighted, doing a Green Deal only in Europe, which emits less than 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions, is not going to be enough. We need a global strategy. And I think it's fair to say that so far, the global initiatives haven't really delivered. I mean, in fact, annual global emissions are now 60% higher than they were at the beginning of the COP process, right? So the international agreement process that was trying to rein in global emissions. So they continue rising. And I think it's a brutal reality that we have to confront. I mean, even if the EU stops emitting, we emit only 10% of global emissions. Just to give the numbers, China emits more than 10 billion tons per year of the 37 or so billion that the world emits. Europe is at below 3.5. So really, we have to make this Green Deal global, basically. And so the question is how and, you know, what can be done and, you know, what are ways of doing this? The Green Deal has major geopolitical implications, which we discuss in a forthcoming paper. I personally think it is time to move beyond the voluntary mechanisms that the Paris Agreement symbolizes. The voluntary agreements run always the problem that countries commit to future action or even just drop out, as Donald Trump has done, because they argue free riding is just too costly. So I think we need to go beyond that. What I'm proposing, I call that a climate club. It's a further development of an idea by William Nordhaus, the Nobel Prize laureate, in which I basically would love us to see Europe and the United States actually to discuss about a mechanism where we agree on some sort of a common border adjustment to third countries. So a mechanism where third countries, in a sense, would be penalized unless they implement similarly ambitious climate policies, while within the club, these kind of penalties do not apply because we all apply the same tougher standards. And of course, ideally, China should be a founding member from the beginning because China is just such an important global emitter and global economy also. So that, I think, would be sort of my wish also for 21, that with the new U.S. administration coming in, with the new U.S. president coming in, who also is pledging to take climate change serious, that, you know, we have really a structured conversation around this topic because it is so important for all of us.
And what else should we expect, since you mentioned the new president of the United States, what else should we expect from the new U.S. administration for transatlantic relations?
Look, I mean, okay, everybody agrees there's going to be a change of tone. And I think that's that, I think, is a good thing because it is a tone of engagement. And that, of course, is music to our ears. And we're never going to achieve the things that Guntram has been asking for unless we have a change of tone, because we would never get to the table, right? But this time we will get to the table. And I actually think that the Biden administration will be very actively engaging with Europe because it realizes that the challenges are so big that you need allies. And, you know, the first ally of the US is the EU. And I think that makes a lot of sense. But I don't believe that there will be much discontinuity in the policies, though, because the reason why the previous administration got there is because there are structural reasons that got it there. So, you know, to think that one day from the other, we're going to see a complete change in policies, I think that's not realistic. And, you know, climate will be the litmus test, in my view, because, as Guntram said, you do have an administration that is very much in the same line with all the things that Guntram described. And yet, I think the backbone of the US might actually want something different or not as avant-garde as we would like it to be. So, you know, I would take climate and consider that the decisive thing of how serious the new administration will be in terms of making change. And they're very serious up front, but I don't know that they have the power to become serious when it means policies. Beyond that, I think the China policy will be the same, except that the US will be seeking to ally with Europe rather than antagonizing Europe, which is optimistic because it might lead to more powerful antagonism against the things that we don't like about China.
And Andrea, speaking about that, what about trade? What shall we expect on the trade area?
I agree that trade is one of the big issues, although everyone expects that at least first year of the Biden administration will be devoted to a domestic agenda, which is quite natural given tremendously bad situation on the health side. With 3,000 people dying every day at the moment, it's clear that the priority has to be on the health front and then on the economic front. And economic means not just growth, but income distribution, the health system, all of those matters, the infrastructure, all of those issues. And there, green, I think, will play potentially a very important role in the recovery plan. Trade, yes, there will be lots of nice words coming out of Washington. And we already heard President-elect Biden pronounce the word multilateralism in relationship to trade on several occasions, something that was unthinkable under Trump. Sure, you know, discussion with the EU and with traditional allies will be there in order to work together on some of the trade issues, including obviously the WTO. So I think all of this sounds very, very good, very optimistic. What can be delivered and in what kind of time agenda, it's more difficult to foresee. I think what at the minimum one can hope is that some of the tariffs that the US imposed, not on China, but on the EU and other traditional allies on steel and aluminum, that those be lifted fairly rapidly. And there the discussion has been, you know, would the US want to get something in exchange for that? Will they simply lift the tariff, or will they say, well, we are lifting the tariff, but, you know, we would like to get some quid pro quo? And I think that's essentially the political arrangement to be done. But I think we can expect in 2021 that those tariffs on steel and aluminum on the traditional allies will be lifted. The China issue is quite different.
And Andre, we will for sure monitor the situation, and probably the Sound of Economics itself will dedicate some episodes during 2021 when the Biden administration will start. And of course, we could continue to speak about so many other topics that have marked this very weird year 2020. But let me rather go to the other part of our podcast, where we wanted to see which was the book that marked your year. And this will also be an interesting reading list for our listeners. And I will make sure that all titles will be appearing in the show notes as well. Who wants to start?
I'm happy to start. One of the books that I read this year and really marked me is called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And the subtitle is The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. And that's by Toshana Zuboff, who is emerita professor at Harvard Business School. And I think it's a very important book where I think we understand a little better that the business model of some of the digital corporations is collecting personal data and monetizing it. And I think a lot of it, you know, is something, you know, they provide a lot of services that we use every day, including right at the moment. And I think that we find very, very convenient and that is improving our lives. Collecting personal data, I don't have great difficulties with that in some extent as far as dealing with sort of commercial issues, even advertising. Okay, you know, we can complain. You get some, maybe too much commercial, but it's like, you know, watch television and there are commercial on televisions. We have gotten used to that. The place where I'm much more critical and worried is when it comes to disinformation, political advertising, effect on the working of democracy. And we have seen some examples in some countries, and that is something that worries me. So it's less about perhaps the economic model, but the economic model merging or morphing in to political implications. What does it mean for our democracy?
Perhaps I can add, because I think my book is sort of directly related to the book that André mentioned. And, you know, of the books I read, the one I found quite inspiring is called The Hype Machine: How Social Media Disrupts Our Elections, Our Economy, and Our Health, and How We Must Adapt. And it's written by an MIT professor and the head of the digital lab at MIT, Sinan Aral, who I thought really put together a lot of very, very interesting evidence about how social media increasingly gets wired into the social fabric and into the everyday fabric of our societies. And goes as far as, just to give you sort of one little thing, which really I found quite shocking, it goes as far as to say that social media dating apps have now become more important in matchmaking between couples than meeting your friend in college or in a bar or whatever. So he goes as far as saying social media may actually even influence genetic dynamics of our population in the future. And so thinking about, you know, how we deal with this and what it all means, I find it fascinating. And when you read the book, you see that really there is no one easy solution. I mean, there's sort of this view in some circles, well, let's just have one solution and that's it. But, you know, it's not, because as André also, I think, pointed out, there's sort of huge benefits from these social media. I love Twitter, right? We all benefit so much from social media, but beyond the promise, there's also the peril. And we have to get that balance right. And I think it's one of the biggest challenge for all of our societies in the coming years, for sure.
Maria, what about your book?
So, I mean, I think there is no doubt that whatever is in the realm of digital is what fascinated us this year. With the close down, the shutdown, we all got used to living behind the screen. So the digital, I think, is really the underlying theme here. And the book that I picked is called Bad Blood. And it is the book that written by a Wall Street journalist called John Carreiro. It is a piece of investigative journalism, which I think is brilliant. Just that is in itself is something worth reading about. But it is a story of yet again another startup in the Silicon Valley, started by a very young lady, a dropout from Stanford called Elizabeth Holmes, who decided to start a new company on blood testing. And in very typical fashion of the Silicon Valley, managed to raise funds and have the promise. But the story actually does not end well. It's a thriller because effectively it's a story that actually is based on deceit. And it unravels. It unravels at the end. And right at the moment as we speak, there are court cases on the firm. So it's a story of a Silicon Valley that has not ended well. We don't get to hear a lot about that. We only hear about the successes. It's nice to sort of hear a little bit of what goes on beyond the successes, just to see how the dynamics play. And you really see there, the most interesting part of the book, which I think is fascinating, is how it managed to survive for as long as it did through deceit, and how people that you wouldn't expect to be naive about what was lying behind that company actually were captured in the promise of a young professional. And it's only through a very, very pursuit of journalism that we managed to find the truth. And as I said, the story is still going on in courts. But it's interesting to see that. And it's a fascinating story about startups that may not go as well as others. And it's fascinating. And it's a very well-written book as well, which I think is always a good thing.
Great. And I have to say that I also picked up a book which was in the realm of the broader digital sphere. I was choosing The Stack on Software and Sovereignty, which is actually quite an old book. It's from 2016. It's written by Benjamin Bratton. And to recap the book, Benjamin Bratton proposes that smart grids, cloud platforms, mobile apps, smart cities, the Internet of Things, I mean, all these things that we've been discussing about in the realm of the digital can be seen not as many individual species of things evolving on their own, but they are forming some sort of coherent wall, what he called the stack, which is taken from computer science. And basically, what is interesting and what I was fascinated from this book is that he manages to help us to understand both the fact that computing is everywhere, which is something that all the three other books somehow have in common. But perhaps the difference here is that it builds a theoretical framework that could be potentially used for many purposes, from design a city to modeling economy to the concept of sovereignty. Basically, it provides a theoretical background to consider companies like Google somehow new kind of subjects of international relations in a post-Westphalian perspective. On the minus side, it's 200,000 plus words, so I would say that it's not really a book to read after the Christmas dinner. Having said that, I would like to have a final wrap. We are towards the end of this episode, and it has been a very challenging year for everyone, so I would like to end on a optimistic note, and rather than trying again an exercise of forecasting, I would just really like to ask the two of you for a wish, not just for the next year, but for the rest of the decade 2020, which probably didn't start in the way we all would have liked to start, but still has quite a few years to go. So what is your wish for 2020?
My wish for 2020 is that we will regain our health, because health is the most important thing. So really, I hope in 21, we can overcome the health crisis, the pandemic. And in overcoming the pandemic, I really hope that as an institution that Bruegel can drive also a discussion about how to be prepared and how to prevent these kind of future pandemics happening through better preparedness, better health system preparedness, better financing for the basic research for vaccines, and so on and so forth. I really think we should draw the right lessons and be able in the future to provide the right global commons, meaning preventing pandemics of that sort reoccurring.
At the beginning of the podcast, Guntram outlined the reasons why we saw a change in the German position when it comes down to the way that Europe comes together. André talked about geopolitics. All these reasons will remain. They will not go away in the next decade. If anything, they will get stronger, in my view. So what I wish for the next 10 years is that Europe manages to come together, not only in big events like the pandemic, but it always comes together and provides decisive solutions to common problems. I think that will make Europe a lot more reliable, credible as a global force, and it will be a lot more effective in preserving our welfare. So I would like to see more Europe, not just more, but better Europe in the next 10 years.
So my wish works very well with the health wish of Guntram, with the wish of more cooperation within Europe. My wish is for more international cooperation to deal with global issues, climate, health, and others, with more European cooperation inside Europe. I think Europe will be able to be an actor at international cooperation. But I think what we have seen in the last two or three years, in particular with China and the US, is something that does worry me. It does sound, as it sounds for many people, a bit like back to the future with the Cold War. And I hope that we can learn the lessons from the past. Yes, to have a giant like China become a big part of the global economy and global politics is not an easy change of the guard, but doesn't mean that it needs to lead to war, cold war, or even hot war. So I think international cooperation is something that we all need to work on. And I think practical matters like climate, like health, are indeed a good way to approach the issues. Those are not too ideological, because we all live on the same planet, we all subject to the same viruses, we will all be subject to the same problems of displacement of population if there are climate issues. And so this is issues that bring us together as a humanity. So to make progress there, I think would be a great step in avoiding the derailment and war. So in the end, my wish is for peace.
Thank you, André. And on this note and this wish for peace, we are at the end of this episode. I would like to thank all our listeners for having followed The Sound of Economics for so many episodes during the whole 2020. And we hope that next year you will be even more to join in and listen to us. In 2021, we will keep innovating The Sound of Economics as a space for discussion, exploration of new ideas, and to help you to understand better economic policy in order to improve it. Happy New Year, and until next time, bye-bye.